welcome to Cruise Club. We've got the need to podcast. This is episode 20. Whew, 20. Eyes Wide Shut from 1999. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi. Fidelio, everybody.
getting in the door early with that. It took 1,200 episodes or something, but we are finally covering a Stanley Kubrick movie. I don't know that we've covered a Stanley Kubrick movie on any podcast.
And it turns out to be his last movie.
Yes.
Yeah. Maybe it's a reverse Cinemakers.
Ooh. We have with us tonight, I'm gonna introduce the voice you just heard second. I'm going to introduce first the former co-host of Monkey Club.
Legendary.
A podcast that in theory could have covered a Stanley Kubrick movie, 2001 A Space Odyssey. Oh.
True.
Chose not to. I don't know why. Maybe it was the fact that they ended after 2.5 months. I don't know. But I'm going to ask the question right now. With us tonight, Chris Podcast. Chris, why did you not cover a Stanley Kubrick movie on your podcast?
That's a good question. I think we couldn't really find time for it in between episodes about skateboarding chimps. So
it'd be really funny if you covered only the first like 45 minutes of that movie. And then it gets to space. You're like, I'm good. No more monkeys. You were also, this is your inaugural Cruise Club. You were on our Mazes and Monsters episode on the other Tom Tom Club. So if you want more of Chris Podcast, you can check out Mazes and Monsters.
Yeah, the magic of Pardew.
Hanks and Memories. Pardew, seriously. Also joining us tonight, he is making his third appearance on the Cruise Club podcast. You heard his voice a couple times already tonight. He is the co-host of the Contenders podcast. Oh, also, Chris is the co-host of Now and Again, the more important one, the one that's still currently going. Monkey Club in our hearts forever.
It's weird, but I didn't remember that.
But Now and Again still exists. With us tonight, the co-host of the Contenders podcast, Mr. Tobin Addington. Hello, Tobin.
Hello.
Thank you both for joining us tonight. And I'm going to say right up top, this is the kind of movie where I'm like, oh, I should be watching way more good movies than I am. Like, why do I choose to watch so many bad movies when there's a movie like this that I could just be like, yes, let me sit down and enjoy this. I'm going to throw out the word masterpiece. I know that Mike had a difficult time with that. I don't want to blow up his spot. Yeah, masterpiece.
It is kind of funny, wonderful. Though. You watch a movie like this, and you're like, oh, right, like, Sidney Lumet has, like, a whole bunch of movies out there, you know? Like, Bogdanovich made some great, like, it reminds you of, like, why, yeah, you don't just have, I don't just need to be watching fun schlock. Like, there's actually great movies out there.
Thank you for Cruise Club extending the cinematic reaches of our depths, or I don't know how to say this, to both this and then Magnolia, the movie we're going to do next episode with someone who's here tonight. Another very long, very good movie from an auteur who apparently showed up on set and offered Tom Cruise his role in Magnolia just by visiting the set here. This movie that took 400 days to shoot.
Whoa. Yes.
A story that takes place over 36 hours, maybe, if that. It's bananas how long, I mean, worth it, but bananas. So you've both been on Cruise Club and Hanks Memories episodes before, so you know sort of how this goes. I don't even know where to begin with this. So Tobin, why don't you kick things off? What is your favorite part? Oh, actually, hold on. Sorry. I think I forgot intentionally, Mike, because it's the pressure of describing a 2-hour and 40-minute movie.
Oh,
but
the plot summary. Yeah.
We're doing a plot summary now because past guest and Chris's former co-host, Christian Larson, said, you know, not everybody has seen every movie.
Mm-hmm.
You probably should do a plot summary. And I'm like, yeah, you know, that kind of makes sense. And if I miss anything, which I'm going to do, let me know. Although...
Not much going on.
No,
so,
yeah.
You know.
There's a lot that happens and not a lot happens. So Tom Cruise plays Dr. Bill Harford. He's married to Nicole Kidman. This is their third movie together. Far and Away, Dropping the Hammer, Mike. I'm going to drop the hammer. Days of Thunder, I mean. And then Far and Away.
I'm going to ask if you like my new hat. How do you like my hat?
Eyes Wide Shut. This is three movies, three-word titles, 9 words in these Nicole Kidman-Cruise pair-ups. So that's something of note. They are married. They are both beautiful people. Obviously, they go to a party, and they both are in sort of sexually provocative instances or occurrences, or they have the ability to have sex with other people and neither does. And they go back and they get high at their apartment, and they have a 9-year-old daughter who's asleep in bed, or 7-year-old daughter who's asleep in bed, and they get high and they get into an argument. And Nicole Kidman's basically like, I had a fantasy about having sex with another man, and I would have left you for him if he was still there. If I woke up the next morning, like, it was real, I would have left you for him. And Tom Cruise says, I don't know what's going on. I don't like this. He gets a phone call. Since he is a doctor, one of his patients has just died. He goes to the patient's apartment. The woman who is his daughter, the patient's daughter, kisses Tom Cruise, says, I'm in love with you. He says, I don't think you're right. On the way home, has a run-in with a prostitute. Brings him into her apartment. We later find out that she is HIV positive. She does not know at that point, but he sort of dodges a bullet there. He's sort of in the mood for something risky. He then meets up with
Want some risky business?
Sorry, he does want some risky business. Thank you. He meets up with a former med school colleague of his, and I also do want to mention that Dr. Chris Podcast is in the works of becoming a doctor, so I'm interested to hear your med school opinions on all of this.
This movie was the inspiration for going to medical school, actually.
I would imagine so. I mean, this is quite the lifestyle. So he meets up with Nick Nightingale, who is now a nighttime jazz club pianist, pries out of him that Nick is going to go play piano at this like super secret, ever-moving party, and no one exactly knows, you know, what it is, but it sounds something that Cruz is not invited to. So he secures a costume, goes there, very quickly is found out that he does not belong there. It's an orgy. It feels like billionaires having billionaire fun, which is sort of the same thing as the party in the beginning. Cruz gets kicked out, almost gets murdered or sacrificed. I don't know what they were going to do, but bad things happen. They kick him out. He tries to figure out what happened. He learns that his friend who threw the party in the beginning has been following him. He is at that party. They basically say, you don't belong here. Go back to your life. He goes back to Nicole Kidman at the end. Things are tense because they've been fighting, and this is, again, a very compact timeline. The last word ever said in a Stanley Kubrick movie, what should we do now, is fuck. So it's a story about a relationship, strong, but sort of falls apart. Like, that's also wildly overcomplicated and also wildly under... Like, I don't know... I feel like that was a terrible description and also, like, a good description, and I don't know. Tobin, if you had to pick a favorite part of this nearly three-hour movie, what is your favorite part, your favorite element, your favorite scene of Eyes Wide Shut?
My favorite part of this movie is Nicole Kidman's... the big monologue, sort of central monologue that starts the whole thing, where she is after the party, right? They're smoking, or maybe it's another night. No, it's after the party. I can't remember.
It's after the party. I think it's that same night.
They're smoking pot. They're getting high, and then they end up with this. They have this argument. She then sort of interrogates him about whether or not he wanted to sleep with these other women and if he can admit it and all this kind of stuff. And then she sits down, and the camera changes to like this profile, and she goes into this monologue that I think she just slays. I think she is so good in that scene. That's my favorite part of this movie.
There's so many things that like three sentence description of that scene makes me want to talk about. I just talked for a while, so I'm going to pump the brakes for a second. Do either of you want to respond to that before I, because I just have trivia floating in my head. I've got thoughts. Like I literally finished this 2 minutes before we started recording. It's as
it's
fresh as possibly
yeah,
be
wow. Super
in
fresh.
My head. Timing was tight, but I got it done. But Mike or Chris, any thoughts on Tobin's favorite scene? Because, I mean, this whole movie is, in my mind, incredible, but that is, whew, that is a performance.
It's a doozy. I almost decided to get Nicole Kidman high to record this, but I held off on it. It seems like she had some really good shit.
Yeah, I mean, I really like the dynamic between Hanks and... Hanks, here I go.
Boy.
I like the dynamic between Cruz and Kidman. I don't know if it has anything to do with them being an actual married couple. I think they're both really great in this movie, actually. And, you know, it's not that I don't like this movie, Joey. I just had a difficult time watching it this go around and everything.
Oh, I understand. I'm not trying to put you on blast.
I've got nothing but love for Kubrick. One of this movie's problems is the sort of depiction of marijuana use. I don't want to go on like a diatribe.
On
a rant or anything.
Is this a waking up in Reno situation?
No, not at all. But I just want to say, like, it just feels like it just doesn't feel like natural in all that sense. Like, I feel like they could have just been drunk, or they wouldn't even have needed the weed or whatever, and like they could have just, the tension was there for me already, you know what I'm saying? Like, one scene, just when they're at that party and they get separated and then they're going off on their flirtations and stuff, and you're like, oh dear, like they're both gonna like do something here, and they don't. Like, it just feels like there's a lot of, when they get together, that there's a lot of stress or something. So like, I don't want to take anything away from her performance at all, because I don't think that it really factors in too much. I think it's just a visual cue to get to say, like, oh, they're in an altered state. Like, they're in a different state of mind right now. So whether or not you're with us or not, like, now you are. Now you know, like, they're high, but they've been sort of, like, mentally off already or something. I mean, that's how I'm reading it.
Is this the monologue you're referring to? Is this... does this end with her saying, while I was with him, you were dearer to me than ever before, and like my love for you was tender and sad?
No, that's the second one, I think, when he's come home. She's had a dream then. I think that's the post-dream one. This is the one where she goes from the thing with like her titties. She has the titties line, which is so funny. But then sits down and like describes meeting the sailor, or the, you know, not meeting, but like seeing the naval officer for the first time, and she talks about him, the naval officer, in this memory of hers, getting a message that night at dinner, the next table over, and leaving. And then that's never come back to, which leaves the possible opening that she did have an affair with him that she just never got a chance to say, because the monologue gets sort of interrupted by the phone call that this guy has died, this patient of Cruz's. So it's left ambiguous that way. That other monologue is really good too, but this one, I think, you have to believe this moment from her for the rest of the movie to make any sense at all. And the degree that it does, I think it's because she performs.
Yeah, I mean, that's two different Nicole Kidman monologues we've each pointed out as like fantastic. So she's not in this movie as much as for as much as they were like, it's Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman. They're married. They're in a movie together where they fuck. She's like not really in it, but when she is, she kills it.
Yeah, I was almost wondering if she was in like somewhere hidden in the orgy scene somewhere, like just standing around, you know, like even in mask and hood or something, if they just put her, you know, to other use because she was there for so long but not in much of the movie.
Here's trivia about the orgy scene that just came out this year, which I think is phenomenal.
Oh yes,
that
sorry,
the mysterious voice of the woman, so we find out that it's Mandy, so the woman who had almost, or I guess it's still an overdose. Like she gets fucked up on heroin and cocaine at the party in the beginning. Tom Cruise goes and attends to her, takes care of her, sort of nurses her back to health a little bit, and just says, you know, you need to go to rehab. We later find out through Sydney Pollack at the end that woman is at the party. She's the one who says to Tom Cruise, you have to get out of here. You know, she's in the mask, but you sort of see, because you see her naked at the beginning, you see her naked at the end, whatever. He identifies her after she dies in the newspaper. He goes to the morgue, and he finds out from Sydney Pollack that was all the same woman all along. News broke this year that apparently the woman who did her voice, because that woman could not really break her British accent, the woman who dubbed her voice, the voice we hear in the movie, is Cate Blanchett.
Mm-hmm. Whoa.
Yeah.
Which is weird and cool. And even though she's British, she's able to pull off the, you know, the American accent.
So. Australian.
This whole movie was also filmed in England, because Stanley Kubrick would not leave. I think he hated to fly.
Yeah, he is.
So this was all filmed in England for a very New York movie. This is all in England.
And he's a super New York guy, if you've ever heard him talk before and stuff. Like, yeah. He's from the Bronx, I think.
Yeah,
and even if he was raised, like, pretty wealthy, like, I think of New York when I think of Stanley Kubrick so hard. And to feel like, to know that, like, he spent most of his life living in the country, in the country of Great Britain, like over in London, England and stuff. Like it just baffles me sometimes, but that was just eccentricity.
So I think what works, going back to Tobin's favorite part, I think what works so well about the Cruise and Kidman dynamic, and I think what works so well about just her performance in this, is what you sort of pointed out, Mike, that it is the fact that they are a married couple. Like at one point, Stanley Kubrick wanted this to be Alec Baldwin and Kim Basinger.
Ooh.
So like, I think he had the idea that he wanted a real married couple to be in the movie together. Because they're married, or they were married,
yes,
right?
Yeah. Right.
And so I think that there's that tension there that you're bringing more to the movie than just meeting an actress or meeting an actor for the first time. There's a shared history, and you're able to bring that for better or worse into the movie. Within a few years, I think, of this movie coming out, they would get divorced, and then he would go on with oh God, what's her name, Katie Holmes. And then, you know, from there, who knows? Yeah, I think there's the reason it feels so raw and so real is because it is real. And also, apparently, Stanley Kubrick refused to let them share. Like, he would give each of them notes and tell them that they could not tell the other person what he told them. And so there's that scene where Tom Cruise is imagining Nicole Kidman and that sailor, that Navy man, having sex. And like, there's like that sort of choppy, really lit in blue dream sequence that was, you know, a minute in the movie, and they shot that for a week, and they had her, they did like 50 erotic poses together, and Tom Cruise was not allowed on set, so like, and she couldn't tell him what they were doing. Can you imagine, you know, you love your wife, you trust your wife, but she's away for a week, you know that she's filming a sex scene with a hot naked model, what is happening? And you're not allowed to talk about it. Like, you want to talk about it, and she's like, I can't, for art, for a movie. Like, that is crazy.
I mean, that's directing. I guess that's a method, you know what I'm saying? That's not, I mean, he was known to do all types of crazy things to his actors and actresses, and people really got, like, just taking it too far, you know what I'm saying? Like, some people would say taking it too far, but, you know, they all were like, well, we'll do anything for Stanley, and you suffer for your art, you know, and it's got to be worth it if you're in a, you know, there's a finite number of those movies, and they're all exceptional, so you get to be in one or two of those. It's like a super elite status kind of thing. So I'm not condoning that kind of directorial behavior or anything. You know, you hear sometimes where guys take like, you know, David Fincher and his 70 takes stories and things like that or whatever, you know, you hear stories and stuff, but like that's, yeah, that's just, that's
well, extreme. the billiard scene at the end here took 200 takes.
Yikes.
Yeah.
You know, apparently, I don't know if Sidney Pollack, I think he was sort of, they said he was overprepared, maybe he was nervous. I don't, it's a big scene, it's a long scene, it's an important scene.
And it's a reshoot, and a recap.
Yeah, 200 right, takes. Right. 200 takes.
Well, and part of that is, in Kubrick's defense, not that he needs my defense, but that he's, as with Fincher, you hear actors talking about the number of takes they do, and especially someone like Sidney Pollack, who is such a trained actor. Sandy Meisner was a teacher of his, and he was a, you know, an actor before he was a filmmaker, and now coming back to acting here again. But he has, so he comes very, as you say, prepared and trained. And Kubrick doesn't want that. He wants to break your habits, right? So part of that is when Fincher talks about it, and I think it was the same for Kubrick, it's you do 70 takes to wear them out. So they stop acting and they're just too tired to act anymore. And then they just are in the scene. And then they sort of, they're able to capture something in that. And I think that's probably the kind of thing that was being done. Doesn't mean it was fun to do necessarily, but it does make sense to me as a way to sort of get a performance like this.
And I think you see that when Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise are in that fight, and it just feels like the kind of fight, or like a similar fight that they've had, not about the fantasy, but just that kind of fight. And you can just see the exasperation on Tom Cruise's face, just like, I don't know how to respond to this. Like, I want to respond, but I don't know how.
Yeah.
And it's true to the character, but also probably like, I can't believe I'm doing this for another fucking time. Like, what is going... Like, Stanley, stop it.
What do you want from me? Yeah.
I cannot. One more little bit of trivia is that Nicole Kidman apparently always wanted to do this movie. Tom Cruise, makes sense, like, hated doing this, but knew that if he ever backed out of this, he would kick himself forever. Like, he wanted to do it, but he kind of hated doing it just because of the sheer amount of work that it was. But, you know, I can sort of see in between that in-between zone. It's... Man, it's a lot. Chris, what about you? What is your favorite part, your favorite moment, your favorite scene... if somebody says, what's your favorite part of Eyes Wide Shut, what do you tell them?
When assholes go, my favorite Christmas movie is Die Hard, I can smugly go, my favorite Christmas movie is Eyes Wide Shut. But actually, it's this whole movie kind of baffles me. Like, it's got a pretty clear plot. It's got a pretty clear theme, I think. There's just something to this movie that still baffles me. Like, I feel like I'm missing something of what Kubrick is saying. I don't know. It's a movie that every time I watch it, I feel like I'm missing chunks of it. Like, stuff has been cut out, and it's there's something blank in my mind to me, and I love that feeling. It frustrates me every time, but I love that. But my favorite scene, if you want my individual favorite scene, it is that billiard scene. And it's not surprising that A, it was a reshoot, B, it was a million takes, because Cruise does an amazing job, maybe not much of an acting job, of looking and just feeling and emoting, being extremely defeated and overwhelmed. Yeah. And that is actually a scarier scene to me than the unmasking at the orgy, personally. I just find that scene so well done and oppressive.
I actually found the second half of this movie to like be kind of like a horror movie this time around.
100%.
And I usually kind of check out after the first half of this movie, after like the whole orgy thing, but then this time I was like, wait a minute, like I'm really getting more into this side of it. And Cruz being, it's almost more like a Hitchcock thing, like the second half or something. And like, this is really cool where they're taking it.
I was just getting major David Lynch vibes like the entire time, just like the, like things feel a little bit off. And I think it's,
yes.
I don't know if it's this, if it's the specific filmmaking techniques that Kubrick is using here, or just like the ability to create a mood and an atmosphere, but like things just feel off. Like you're unsettled by everything. Everybody's so close to each other, and the way that they're talking to each other like doesn't feel real, but it feels real. And the soundtrack, the score is creepy, and the music in like the diegetic and non-diegetic, like all of it is creepy. Like everything about this just makes you like makes my skin crawl.
Yeah.
And I love it.
There's almost like a dreamlike quality to some of this film, where it's like that kind of state, you know, almost like Lynch light, I would say, or something. And, you know, I think part of that is because, you know, the dream of hers, or like that becomes sort of the thing about like the sailor, I think that weighs on his mind, and it goes from like, it turns sort of like into a nightmare, you know what I'm saying? And I don't know if everything that happens is actually happening the way it's happening, or if it's inflated through his mind and his state of being at the time, and, you know, all of his anxieties that are just like manifesting and stuff. So like, yeah, I'm with you guys on that, especially Chris. I get that whole sort of like I'm not quite sure if I got a handle on what's going on, but I like it. It's like keeping me on an edge or something.
And mentioning sailors, my favorite sailor is Sailor Ripley. There's another David Lynch right there.
Well, in regards to this being a Dream Logic movie, I completely agree. And it, as much as I love Lynch, this might be my favorite movie that you can call quote-unquote Dream Logic. When I hear that, when people throw that around and you know, film forums, internet, stuff like that. The two people that are mostly connected with Dream Logic to me are David Lynch and Dario Argento.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I feel like Argento's is, I've always kind of been of the weird outlier opinion where I think those movies are just shittily made and you slap a pink gel on a movie that sucks and all of a sudden it's dreamlike. No, thank you. But this is the most Dream Logic movie that still has like a logical through line and it's linear. There's no dwarfs talking backwards, you know? It makes sense. The Dream Logic infects the real world versus the other way around. And I love that. And it does feel insanely creepy. And it's like cruises in like this weird simulacrum of reality. And I love it. I love it. It does, like I said before, the movie baffles me in a lot of ways, but and that's part of it. But I adore just how off this entire movie feels.
So a lot of people refer to this as his, as Kubrick's unfinished masterpiece, because he died, he finished the cut, like he put together the movie that he wanted to make and he turns it in and then 4 days later he died. And so the movie wasn't done, like the score wasn't done and other elements weren't done, but the movie, like the version, the cuts, the edit, all of that, I think, as far as I know, what we're seeing is what he put together. It's just that there was more work to be done after that. So it's sort of unfinished in that sense, but it's also kind of the finished thing. But I think there's a frustration from people, Chris, in terms of that feeling that you have that people want more, they want more answers, which, you know, whether or not this was exactly what he wanted to do or not, which it seems like it is, I think people want to sort of be, have their hand held and walk through, like, what does this all mean? There's one piece that I have not read yet that I'm going to link on the show page on cageclub.me. It's called Introducing Sociology, a Review of Eyes Wide Shut by Tim Kreider. And apparently, like, this is a very, very long thing, but I've heard nothing but amazing things from this. And I did not read this intentionally, because I didn't want to just be quoting from this all night. And it's bad enough that I'm quoting from IMDb Trivia all night. But there's going to be this, like, very in-depth thing, offers more insight and workings and knowledge and how it all happens that I'm going to link on cageclub.me. So if you want to read more about this, if after, or you know, pause the podcast and go listen to it, or go read this thing. But again, there's so much out there that's been written about this movie. It deserves it because you're right. Like it tells a confusing story in a way that makes sense, but also frustrates you, but like in a good way.
Yeah. And like, it's crazy that Kubrick made this movie. I mean, maybe it's not so nuts looking back and seeing like Lolita and stuff like that, but that he would make a masterpiece about like marriage and fidelity and things like that, like something that nowadays that kind of stuff is like rom-com or melodrama kind of stuff, I feel. Not that that's bad or anything, but just Kubrick would sort of say like, no, like there's another way, there's more sort of like artistic or sort of other way to look and approach like a marriage kind of thing. And I don't know, that's the thing this time around I think that I was struggling with. And maybe it's because like I'm older now and like I haven't seen this movie in almost 5 or 6 years or something like that. But like the different themes are popping up for me now that I'm older. And maybe that's what's making me sort of uncomfortable and having me mm-hmm. have to like pause this and stop this a few more times. Because like just in that regard, I'm sort of like closer to the issues. Like they're a little more relatable. And I don't know that I like that necessarily. It's just making me feel my own age. And so like it's interesting how like it's just reflecting. I'm finding reflections through this piece of art, and you know, every time I watch it, like something else is popping up. So
yeah, I have to echo that. So the first time I saw this movie was in the theater. I went opening night. It was my first time seeing a Kubrick movie in the theater.
And same here.
At that point, I knew what Kubrick was.
Real quick question: chronologically, what was the movie that he put out before this?
Full Metal Jacket. Yeah, it was.
Was that like, what's that, like
87?
87-ish?
87, I believe.
4 or 5, I think.
So it had been a while.
It had been a long time.
Okay.
So my mom and I went together to on opening night. Which is not as unusual as it. I mean, my grandmother and I went to American Pie 2 in the theater on opening night together. So yeah, but for whatever reason, it wasn't and I don't remember it being like this. Oh my god, I'm watching this movie with my mom. Like it was just, oh my god, she wants to go to like a Kubrick movie. This is great. Let's go to a Kubrick movie together. I do always flash to that as the movie, because as the movie in spools, you kind of go, okay, this is I probably was a little more uncomfortable than I remember. I have wrestled with this movie every time I've seen it. Maybe half a dozen times now, and I kind of wrestle with it every time, and I enjoyed it the least watching it this time. And I think the part of the reason gets to something that Mike was talking about, which is that the whole movie is basically driven by how fragile Tom Cruise's ego is. Mm. That he cannot accept that his wife wanted to have sex with someone else. And it sends him into this, like, mind-blowing tailspin.
Yeah.
And it's like, seriously, dude? Like, get over yourself.
Yeah.
And the frustration I have with him and that and the character is a bit of a barrier to me now in terms of enjoying the movie, because it's hard for me to be on any kind of journey with him because I'm frustrated with him, and I watch it maybe a little bit with my contender's glasses on, and so I'm sort of seeing it in a new way. But that did bother me this time.
I think there's something interesting. I mean, I think that's the point of the movie, maybe, is that he's acting out what Nicole Kidman just is, like, essentially too faithful to actually follow through on. Like, she has these fantasies, but he's actually trying to go live them. Like, he's just like, well, she thought about cheating, I'm going to go actually cheat. And I think it's fascinating to watch this movie from that perspective, that you're not rooting for him, but you're like, I can't believe, like, the double standard. Like, he's the hero. Like, he's the one you're following. He's the one you're supposed to be, like, in the mind of. But you're right. Like, it's fascinating to watch, I think, him go through and not realize that what he's doing is just what he's accusing his wife of. How dare she even think of it?
Yeah. Yeah. He's completely oblivious. Like, everybody in this movie, man and woman, are basically, like, throwing themselves at him.
Yeah,
and
everyone can't tell. Yeah. Him. Yeah,
and
yeah,
he can't tell. Like, he is just, like, on his own cloud. Yeah, it gets me too, but I almost wonder if that's sort of, like, the magic of this movie is, like, not only is that supposed to, but, like, you get to a certain part of your life where you realize, oh, wait, like, he's not a hero or whatever. Like, he's not the protagonist I thought he was. Like, and the movie just becomes, like, a whole other movie. Like, still really enjoyable and stuff, but I think, like, maybe more difficult. And not, like, in a bad way, but it's good when it re-challenges you. And, like, very few movies, like, can do that when you rewatch them.
Because I wonder if you could watch this through, like, and especially now, you know, Tobin, with your contender's glasses. And I do want to say that I like how you and your sister both have going to a Cruise movie with your mom sort of at an inappropriate time, her seeing Cocktail at, like, 3 years old or whatever,
yeah,
being buried under a blanket during, totally, you know, waterfall sex scenes or whatever. But I wonder if you can read this movie, and I'm sure you can, through the eyes of, like, the oblivious white male privilege. Like, there's no reason for him to be able to be at that party other than, I want to be there. Like, you're not invited. You don't know anything about it. Like, he's like, how did you know? How did you find out? He's like, well, you left all these breadcrumbs. I mean, you showed up in a taxi. We found the rental slip. Like, what did you, like, you're not even good at this. I think there's probably an ironic reading of his character that he feels like he is, you know, impervious to bullets, but he's just a dum-dum. Like, he's a smart guy, he's a doctor, he's great at his job, but he's emotionally dumb, not good at things.
Socially, like, inept, you know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, can't pick up on, like, all these cues and stuff. And it's just crazy, like, because you look at his life and you're like, wow, he's, like, super rich and has it all and all this. And then you look at, like, Sidney Pollack's, like, one room at the end of the movie with the billiard thing. It's, like, the size of his apartment. You're like, oh, right, that's, like, a whole other level of fuck you money that they're dealing with at that orgy level. Like, it's crazy because it's, like, even in that status level, there's still, like, it's not enough for him. You know what I'm saying? He's got it all, but, like, he still needs more than all.
So I think one of the themes of this movie is the fantasy versus the reality. And I'm not talking about life. I'm talking, I guess, about the idea of infidelity, the fantasy versus the reality of it. And I think it's important. I'm going to disagree that Tom Cruise's character is socially inept. I think at the beginning with the two women, you see that he is actually very charming and he is quite good at this. And he is very socially adept, actually. But the whole thing, he's experiencing the reality of the fantasy. And it is a fucking nightmare, like, literally and figuratively. Like, he has to be torn down throughout all of it. I think by the end, he is at that level. As the billiards guy says, like, you've been way over your head the last 24 hours. You can kind of see this deconstruction of the masculine, like, ideal of what he's trying to do, which is, like, Nicole Kidman says, like, men will stick it at anything, and women just have to do it for security. And it's kind of tearing all that down to me. So I think that's kind of where I agree and disagree with what was kind of thrown about there.
I think whether you read the movie in the one way or the other, like, whether he is socially competent and aware of himself and, you know, just struggling to get by, or whether he's just a complete, you know, not airheaded buffoon, but just in over his head, I think that one thing kind of rings true is that, like, he's he's selling it. Like, he's able to perform this role. Tom Cruise as the actor is able to perform this role in a way that just leaves it open to interpretation, which I think is just fascinating.
I mean, maybe it's because we're going down this road together, Joey, but like, he's just freaking jumping off of the screen, like everything, like all of, like when he's like really close in the prostitute's apartment and just like starts like laughing, it's like all the little Cruise mannerisms are like on full display here. Somehow there's like, you know, I just see him not reaching, but he's like pulling out like all the stops here, and I'm loving his performance.
Is this the least Tom Cruise movie? He's playing a character so not in his type. You know, he's not sprinting at the camera. He's not getting into gunfights and stuff. There's multiple scenes where he, or Kubrick forces the women are taller than him, which is something that I know he doesn't mm-hmm. quite let happen in a lot of movies he has more control over. Is this the least Cruise movie?
Possibly. No, I can't believe he didn't run in this movie at all.
I know.
Quite honestly.
He should have run. He wanted to run, right?
Yeah. He's like, you know, mentally running. Yeah, you know, that's interesting. Like, you know, I think we've talked a little earlier about how Cruise has always been just edged out Hanks early on with like the dramatic stuff. You know, he could do Rain Man. You know, there's parts of Cocktail that I think he's pulling off. You know, we just haven't seen that off like in a couple movies. Like, he hasn't really reached into the dramatic bag where he can like slow down and take his time with a role. So maybe he's just like kind of relishing in the moment here with this role, and next one with Magnolia, like he just gets on like a roll, no pun intended, I just can't think of another word for it, but like just gets kind of into it, right? And like does a couple more or of these kinds of things before getting back to like blowing stuff up.
I think what we've seen, and I think that to sort of take what Mike said and go back in time a little bit, the movie he did immediately before this is Jerry Maguire. Up to that point, we really hadn't seen, aside from Far and Away, the second movie he did with Nicole Kidman, we hadn't really seen romantic Cruise. Like, he had relationships in movies, you know, like him and Kelly McGillis in Top Gun, but him as like a romantic lead hadn't really been done. It was just the one time in Far and Away he chose to act like he basically had them hire Nicole Kidman, and they were like, I think they had just gotten married. There was like, it's not really acting. I mean, it's acting, but it's a different kind of acting. Like, when you're like, I want to be comfortable, like my love interest is my wife. Between Jerry Maguire and this movie and then Magnolia, what we're going to get to next, I think he's consciously, intentionally trying to go against type. I think like what Mike was saying, and just see if he can stretch himself out. And I think this is probably the biggest example so far of not what he is, because he is, like, on the outside, he is still that cocky, handsome, you know, he can do anything, he's king of the world, but he shows a vulnerability in this movie that we haven't really seen a lot of. You know, he has to learn a lesson in Top Gun, like, his friend dies, he has to, like, you know, he has his down-and-out moment, and then he has to rebound. I think that this is a deeper look into the psyche of that kind of character, because I think it's very much the same character he's been playing, but it's sort of through a different angle or a different lens or a different filter or just a deeper look into it, and just seeing the fragility of it and just the inability to do X, Y, and Z.
It's a huge gamble for him. Like, he's cashing a big check here, right? Because in 96, both he gets his second Oscar nomination for Jerry Maguire, and Mission Impossible is this huge hit and one that he produced too. So he's sort of, you know, a big force behind the camera, so taking control in a kind of different way, and then spends 3 years making this movie, not doing anything else but this movie. And at the sort of the height, well, what felt like at the time, the height of his sort of power, to go off and do, and it's probably the only way this movie gets made, right? Is someone of Cruise's stature to be able to bankroll shooting for 400 however many days in London. But it does feel like he's trying to stretch himself to prove something else, to work with a different director, and I like that he did that. I think he's fine in the movie. I don't think this is anywhere near his best performance. I don't think he's a great fit for the role. I think he's miscast in the movie. I don't think anybody else could have gotten it made. So I guess I don't know what, and I'm applauding him for doing it. I'm not saying he's doing a bad job, but I think this is a Richard Gere part. Someone who can work in a slightly different register, I think. And yeah, I don't know. I think he's miscast, but I think he does a nice job here.
I would like to slide into the Baldwin Basinger universe where they made this movie, honestly.
Have you seen The Getaway, the movie they made together where they have unsimulated sex?
I feel like I have. Maybe I haven't, since I can't actually remember it. Is it really boring?
Yes.
Okay, well, maybe that's why.
Just watch the Steve McQueen one.
Exactly.
So apparently also in history, at different points in development, Stanley Kubrick wanted Woody Allen in the lead here, which,
oh, boy, I hate that.
This started as some kind of a comedy and became a drama, but Woody Allen at some point, Harrison Ford at one point, Alec Baldwin, Kim Basinger at one point, Johnny Depp was considered at one point.
This started as a comedy? It's
I mean that's what IMDb says. I don't know I don't know how you put Woody Allen in this not a comp. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, yeah.
You know, the tough thing, you know, Tobin, as you're saying that, I'm trying to think, like, on Letterboxd, you know, I know I've been ranking all of the Cruise movies in order, and like, it's a weird order, and I can't really, like, my friend was asking me, he's like, how, like, this morning, he's like, how is your Tom Hanks list in, or like, what order is that in? I'm like, I can't really explain it. It's like, how much I like the movie, how good I think he is in it, how much I'd want to watch it again.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, the clearest example that I can give of this is that when we did Cage Club, like, Fast Times, I love Fast Times. Like, Fast Times is incredible. I love it just almost across the board, unconditionally. But Nicolas Cage is in that movie for 15 seconds.
Yeah, yeah.
So on the list of his 90-whatever movies, it's like 50 or 60, because it's better than a lot of his terrible movies, but it's not a great Nicolas Cage movie. The lists have a weird alchemy that I can't exactly define. Like, I'm really struggling. This is the first time that I've struggled to figure out where to place a Tom Cruise movie, because like, it's somewhere in my top five of his. Like, when we did two episodes ago, or three episodes ago, Mission Impossible, like, Mike and I both came out, we were just like, I can't believe how good this is.
Couldn't believe it.
It blew us away. It's just like, this is him. Like, he found exactly what he needs to do. And I think that he is incredible in this movie. I think this is probably the best movie that we've done for this, like, in terms of how well it's made, the best Cruise movie that we've seen so far. I just don't know, with my muddied alchemy of this list, where this belongs. It's so weird. Like, it's weird in those regards, and I don't know, like, I love it, but it's a lot of weird different boxes.
In what way is it the best movie? I mean, we have seen A Few Good Men and The Firm together, and I would put both those movies above this.
Oh, well, I don't think The Firm is very good. I think The Firm is weird and goofy. And
I'm on The Firm train. Tobin, one day I'd like your thoughts on Bonfire of the Vanities. This is not The Firm, but just put a pin in that, please. Okay. Oh, God, I loved it.
So, I mean, of the movies, and again, this is independent, none of this, I mean, I can't defend any of this other than just my gut feeling, but of the movies, of the 20 movies that we have now watched for Cruise Club, I've given two of them 5 stars. I gave this movie and I gave A Few Good Men 5 stars.
Yeah, okay.
And I have them both in my top five. You know, I think that A Few Good Men is an immaculate movie. I think this is, I don't know, I just, there's something about this. The
it's one of a kind, yeah.
Confidence of it,
totally.
The uniqueness of it, even though it's not exactly, but it is, like, there's just something about this movie. Like, I feel like A Few Good Men is one of the best versions of a movie that has been made a ton, and this is the best version of a movie that has been made once.
Yeah, okay, yeah, yeah. Good point. Yep.
I can't defend it or articulate it better than that.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah, I see that.
I want weird stuff.
Kubrick, you know, everyone, you know, he's in a class of unto himself, you know, and these are reasons why. You know what I'm saying? Like, there, it's almost gets to a point sometimes with his films when you're talking about it, it's like uncomparable, or at least for me. Like, it just starts, you know, you just start talking about him and like maybe relating him back to like his other work, and then, you know, or like we're getting off on like trivia tangent and stuff. But I love it, and I love all of his movies and stuff. But
Mike, have you said your favorite? Because I haven't said mine.
No.
I don't even know what mine is. I'm trying to think about it. But Mike, what's your favorite part of this movie?
I do have a favorite part, and it's partially, it's my favorite and maybe my least favorite part. I don't know. That happens once in a while.
So wait, do you want to... Hold on. Let me do mine, and then we can use yours as the pivot point. Is that okay?
Yeah, okay. That's fine.
My favorite part... So when I first saw this movie, I saw... Basically, I was like going through IMDb's top 250 one summer, and I think it was like right after I took a class with Tobin. It was like between like my sophomore and junior year, and I was just like, here's all the movies that I saw, and you were like, wow, like you saw all these movies. I was like, yeah, and then like I in my head I was like, I don't remember anything about any of them. Like, I just, you know, watch, it's just the same thing now. Like, I watch so much that I don't know, I can't retain anything. But like, it was the same summer where like in 4 days I watched like Apocalypse Now and Platoon and Full Metal Jacket, and I'm like, I got Vietnam down, but now I don't remember.
Miserable.
It's just like, I don't know what's going on. Back when I saw this, when I was probably 20 for the first time, which I feel like, I know that a lot of us probably saw it when we were 20 for the first time. I feel like I was just too young, and I remember just like the movie opens with Nicole Kidman stepping out of her dress. I'm like, ooh, nudity. Like, I like this already. But what I'm saying tonight is my favorite part is that the next scene that we see of them getting ready for the party is so beautifully made, and the tracking shot of following him, and then all of a sudden the camera stays on her, and then it's her scene, and then it follows back to him, and then he turns off the music that does not feel like it belongs in the, like, it's just the music that they're listening to, and it's so jarring and striking, and like, what I think this is not, and it's just unsettling and masterfully done, and I was just like, wow. And I didn't even take notes on this movie. I just watched this movie. I'm like, I don't need to take notes. It's gonna be in my brain. I'm gonna just talk about it. But then I was just like, wow, like, this is It's incredible.
The fun thing, I don't know, the interesting thing about that, which I think says something, is you've got this long tracking shot, and traditionally you have like those kind of things for fights or chases or something like that, or, you know, your Goodfellas. And this is just them being extremely fucking married and domestic. Like, she's like, she's like pissing in front of him while they go, and they're talking about stuff that doesn't matter, and their kids, babysitter and stuff. And it's just, you know, the most boring married couple shit, and it's getting this beautiful striking shot and blocking, and it's just, I think that's on purpose, and I think that is a point that is being made.
That's such a good point. It makes this the stakes of the, like, it is these are the action sequences of this movie, right? Like, the Titanic stakes of this movie is their marriage and their fidelity. Yes. Yeah, you're totally right. That makes sense.
And the music that makes it so, like, much more important maybe than it is, or like it just gives it that air of like sophistication or grandiose, whatever. Like, it's very important what we're seeing right now, which is marriage, you know.
Mm-hmm. So Mike, hit us with it. What is your least favorite and your favorite part? You're two for one.
So I mean, it's hard to pick like a least favorite part of this movie, so I'll say my favorite, and then it's not necessarily my least, it's just the part that I never really, I don't know that I understand it. So the rainbow rental sequence. Yeah. Love it. Like, love that's like, I just think it's like incredible. Like, the guy, the actor who runs the place, like renting of the tuxedo and all that kind of thing. And but I don't understand the Lily Sobieski part. Like, I mean, I get it, but I don't understand necessarily. Like, I know Kubrick is trying to say, like, there's all kinds of sex and all kinds of risky sex and all kinds of dangerous things. And, like, I just think that we didn't necessarily need to explore pedophilia or underage sex in this movie. Maybe he's trying to say, you know, Cruz has a young daughter in this film. This might be a vision of that future or something, but I struggle every time with the end of this sequence. Like, I just love everything else about it. And even when they find them back there, I'm like, okay, like, let's just end it. But then she goes on to be like this very sort of like nympho sort of character. I struggle with that every time. It's not destroying the film or anything, but I just need help like understanding it. So best to worst for me.
It's certainly a weird scene, and the fact that it comes back later, like, it's weird enough on its own, and then for it to return and everything's normal, it's like, oh, this is even weirder than I gave it credit for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe that's it. Maybe the idea that there's, like, that second punch to it where it's like, oh, like, actually, we worked it all out. Like, we came to an arrangement, and everything's cool. And it says so much about consent, and I'm just not sure, like, I don't know that I'm smart enough or anything, but I'm in the middle of another movie, I feel, you know? And then suddenly, like, I'm literally over the rainbow, and I don't know what's, like, happening. Where am I? Like, all kinds of weird shit is going on too quickly, and I'm about to go to an orgy. So, like, it's not really helping prep. It's okay. It just, I guess it felt gratuitous to me, and nothing really else does in this movie.
If I had to guess, there's a lot of rainbow imagery in this movie, some more obvious than others, like the fact that place is fucking called Rainbow. It's kind of going with the idea of this being the deconstruction of that male sexual fantasy. He's constantly chasing the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, and every time he gets there, it's just more and more fucked up.
Yeah, like the dream he's chasing turns out to be a nightmare.
Yep.
Essentially, right? Like, what he thought he wanted is like, actually, this is not what I want at all.
Oh, that's
shit.
The bullshit I'm on.
Because doesn't, in the very first scene, when he's with those two women, he says, where are we going to go? And she says, where the rainbow ends. And it feels like that's kind of the best case scenario. Like, who knows what would have happened in that scene? Plus, it would have broken up the marriage, possibly. But, like, it feels like, compared to what he's about to see with Lily Sobieski and the, you know, the ritualistic sex orgy and everything like that, in theory, having, like, an innocuous threesome feels like the best case scenario. And, like, you're right, Chris, like, every time he encounters the rainbow, it gets darker. Tobin, what about you? What is your least favorite part? I know you said that you like this the least this time of all the times you've seen it. What about this that does not work for you the most? I know you said Cruz is kind of miscast here. Is that your thing that you're going to hang your hat on, or what's your least favorite part of this movie?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to pick out a bad scene because it's made by Stanley Kubrick and he makes really good fucking scenes. And I do think I would have loved to see a different actor in this part, because I think it would have been more clear the destruction of the male ego fantasy thing, what I think would have been just a touch more well drawn, I think, with someone. But that aside, next to Mike's pick, which is an excellent pick for worst scene, the Lily Sobieski stuff I could do without. The other one is the intercut with Cruz, his flirtation with the two women at the party, is Nicole Kidman's flirtation with the Hungarian guy as they're dancing. I love Nicole Kidman in so much of this movie, but the two of them in that dance sequence together, her quote-unquote drunk acting is not, I'm not buying it. It throws me out of the movie every time when that scene comes on. It's always bugged me, that scene.
It kind of came on in a hurry, didn't it?
She throws back one glass of champagne and then feels like, and who knows what they've done to the champagne. One of the things I like about this movie is the way that it starts at this, you know, starts at Sidney Pollack's house, or wherever, I assume that's his house, and he's throwing this lavish party, and it's all, they're all rituals that we recognize. And then later in the movie, Tom Cruise goes to a big fancy house, and we don't know then that Sidney Pollack is there, but he is. And they're having another kind of ritual that we don't have familiarity with. But they're both these sort of mating ritual places. We just are more familiar with the rules in one, the rules in the other. So I like that this scene happens. I like that this is taking place. I just think I do not buy her in the scene the way that I do later on in the movie, where I am completely locked in with her.
I think in that regard, it's kind of a bummer, because I think that scene starts out so well. Like, I don't have the same faults that you have with it, I don't think, but I agree that it ends in a way that I wish sort of had smoothed to that point a little bit more, but that scene just starts so well.
Yeah,
like, I just think that them being, like, her being so flirty and so confident and, like, sort of giving a window but not quite, and just, it's so good.
Because it does feel a little truncated. Like, we do get to see Cruz do more at the party, right? Like, I mean, he's called upstairs to deal with something, and he's talking to the women. He meets Nick. He has a conversation with him. And Nicole Kidman just, like, talks to the one person. Granted, then they go dance, but it would have, you know, been more interesting if she had more adventures at the party on her own, right? And you see, like, oh, like, of course, this Hungarian guy who's, like, 20 years older than her desires her. But, like, I want to see where, like, the younger guy is also there. You know, where's the handsome model for her and all those kinds of things going on, too. And, like, you know, maybe she's called away because we find out what her profession was or what she used. You know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. I just feel like it's a great place to develop character, like, at a dinner party. And they sort of slip on her there.
Chris, what about you? What's your least favorite part of this movie?
That's really tough. Like, while you were asking other people, I had to pull up the Wikipedia just to find, you know, get something in my head that I disliked.
Oh, my things are going to be such ticky-tack, petty little bullshit that whatever you say is going to be more meaningful than mine.
I'll say the morgue scene isn't very well shot, or it's not. I get why it's done to set up the was it her kind of mystery, but I just think it's kind of flat and uninteresting, and like him going in to like kiss her on the forehead then not doing it, it's just a little too pathetic, a little too soon, and I don't love how that scene is done.
Yeah, I hear that for sure. Like, I almost thought, while I do really like the back half of this movie, I was like, really? Like, they're gonna let him into the morgue and like see it, they're not even related. But then, you know, I was like, oh, okay, like this could be some of that dream logic at work, or just, you know, you just got to take it for what it is at this point. And it's because, like, you know, you give other movies that explore,
I mean, he's flashing
paranoia.
His doctor's badge like it's a police officer's badge, right? He's just like, let me in here.
Right. Yeah. So it's almost like mind power, right? It's like Professor X. It's like, this is whatever, this piece of paper is whatever it needs to be. Or that's Doctor Who, right? I don't know. I'm getting it mixed up.
But I also think that, like, that kind of leads into the way that we were talking about before, of a way you could read this, that, like, he thinks that he belongs in all these places, and he sort of talks his way into it, right? Mm, like, it's that, yeah. You know, not the fragile male ego, but just, like, the entitlement, where he's just like, oh, no, I'm allowed to go here. I'm a doctor. It's like, well, what does that mean? Like, I don't, what? No, what?
This movie is about power, especially among the wealthy. That ties into it, him getting his way into there like that. The fact that in that scene is the only black person in New York. He works in a basement. Things like that. A lot of this movie, and I'm sure it'll come up as we get into the orgy scene, really is just about showing off your power. And I guess maybe I didn't think about it, but there's probably some sort of sexual link to that too. Freud, because someone who loves Freud is slapping themselves on the head right now, yelling at the speakers.
So my least favorite parts, and again, this is, I'm prefacing it by saying these are the dumbest things in the world. I did not catch these, but apparently there are VHS copies of both Rain Man and Full Metal Jacket in this movie, which
no
does
way.
That mean that Tom Cruise is an actor in this world? Like, is this like an Ocean's 12, Julia Roberts test situation?
This is kind of a Kubrick cameo kind of thing. Like, in Clockwork Orange, the score to 2001 A Space Odyssey is predominantly in frame when Alex goes to the record store, as are, I feel like, several other of his movie records. So, like, I think that's just him saying, like, his way of, like, putting Easter eggs in or something.
Sure. And also, I think he's in here somewhere. I think he's in the jazz club when he meets up with Nick Nightingale again. He's in a booth over there. So I'm allowing him to do it, but I just think it's a weird thing. Again, ticky-tack. Another thing, very minor thing, and maybe it's just because they shot in England as opposed to New York, where you actually need it. Considering how beautiful and how furnished and how spacious Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman's apartment is, they don't have central air. They have window air conditioning units. And it's like, what? And it's a minor detail, but I'm like, why is that? Like, my eyes just went to that, because I was, not too long ago, about a year and a half ago, I was looking to buy a house, and that was one of my, like, I don't want window air units. I want central air or something like central air.
Oh, man.
And so just, like, my eyes are sort of trained there and just saw them in multiple windows. I was like, that's weird, because they're very clearly very well off, right?
I feel like Kubrick would be proud that you found that. Like,
yeah, if there's a room 237 about this movie, like, mine's the air conditioning is the secret key to everything. Like, you know, keeping cool under pressure.
I'm willing to jump into the 237 with you on this one, actually. Do they ever say what kind of doctor he is? Is he a plastic surgeon?
He's not a hair doctor.
Well, because he has like women patients, but then he has little kid patients, right?
Okay.
So what kind of general practitioner does that? He's not a pediatrician, right? And
not family medicine. Yeah. Family medicine could do that.
Okay.
I specifically remember the only thing about the doctor stuff I really remember is him, like, very professionally looking at women's breasts.
Right.
So that's maybe why I thought he was a plastic surgeon. But I want to kind of jump into that, because in my kind of thesis about this being about power, we're seeing Tom Cruise flash this power throughout the movie, right? People see doctors as an important, a powerful position. One of my favorite lines from Scrubs is Dr. Cox going, there's only four reasons to get into being a doctor, women, sex, power, and sex. You think that until you see how that compares to, you know, your politicians, your billionaires, you know, your deep state people who are doing this Carcosa shit in these traveling mansions. And he gets smacked down, like, because he does not, in relation, he is not all that powerful. He is nothing. Him being a doctor ties into a couple of points that are being made in this movie, and that is one of the major ones. So maybe the air conditioner is showing that they aren't as well off as they might like to imagine.
Oh, but, I like that.
Maybe I don't want a super 237 this one yet. I don't know.
He's kind of a big fish in a small pond, right? But then if you go into the bigger pond, he's a nothing, right? Because he is a doctor. He has power. He is, you know, when he goes to a party, like, he knows no one there, but he can tell these pretty young models, oh, I'm a doctor. And because he's handsome, they're like, oh, he's a catch.
Yep.
And then you go to a place where people actually have money, actually have fuck you money. It's just like, oh, you don't belong here. You're not one of us. Like, sure, you have a beautiful apartment, but, like, you don't own... Based on the window, like, looking out at the end in that billiards room when they're at Sidney Pollack's place, I think that's just, like, an apartment building. Like, I think that's just, like, a two-story, massive, like, house-like apartment that he owns, which I can't imagine how much that would cost. Like, this is just a level of wealth that is incomprehensible.
Right. Yeah, he's got way more... He's way more powerful. He's one of the masked guys. He's one of the people who gets to be there. He gets to be doing that, you know, Bohemian Grove kind of shit.
Fidelio rich.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yes, that's a good. Yeah, and he's only there, like, to watch too, probably, right? He's just standing in the corner, nodding approvingly, like, yes, yes, power, yes, yes, I feel it.
There's theories that he's the Red Cloak guy, but it's really just kind of fan fiction, and based on the fact
that... I mean, it's got to be the guy who nods at Tom Cruise from the balcony, right?
That could be it too.
Because, like, why else would that guy, why else would he nod, like, why would a random person, I mean, it doesn't matter, but why would a random person nod to him?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, because he is recognized, like, not just by, you know, him, but by the woman, too, the one, and she was, like, basically passed out after he helped her, and he just gave her, like, you know, she had just come to from ODing in Sidney Pollack's bathroom, and she recognized him at the party in the mask.
In the mask, so, like, yeah.
So there must have been something, like, about the mask, or his movements, or, you know, there's telltale signs, I'm sure. There's, like, a whole list of bullshit they all had to remember before cloaking up.
Now, I know that we talked about a lot of things. I know that we could talk about this movie for 400 days and talk about it for, you know, everything else. Is there anything else about this movie, any big scenes, any big moments that you want to make sure that we cover? Because we did our favorite and least favorite moments, but I don't want to, you know, not that we might never talk about this movie again unless we do Kubrick on Cinemakers at some point, but anything else about this movie, I'm going to start by just saying that, Mike, this is one of the very first, very few times that we've seen Cruise as a dad, and it's a little bit of a bummer that we don't really explore that dynamic at all, really, right? Like, he's just, he's a husband, and that's the key, his key role kind of in this is, like, whether or not he's a good husband. But the fact that he's a father really plays into none of this, and that's kind of a bummer because, you know, especially after we saw the shockingly charming still Jonathan Lipnicki in Jerry Maguire and how well he interacts with him there, I kind of wish we had a little bit more, but that's not this movie at all.
I mean, I think, like, his daughter is, like, an issue, but it's not front and center whatsoever. And certainly with Jerry Maguire, like, he just snapped right into, like, father role with that relationship. Like, some might say, like, jumped in there a little too soon, took a little bit of an advantage of... Go listen to that episode. It's a great one. It's a good movie. But yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. Like, I hope the next time that we see him as a family man, he's like a family man, you know, like has the time to play with the kids, roll around in the grass, do all that kind of cool crap.
But Chris, is there anything else, any other scenes, any other big moments that we make sure that we discuss on this episode?
I think we kind of have to talk about the elephant in the room here. I had a tougher, I don't know, a different experience watching this movie this time. I made that joke at the beginning, but like, I'm kind of serious about that because Stanley Kubrick is sort of involved, well, you know, allegedly involved with some conspiracy theories. And I think that he is kind of commenting on that in this movie. You know, we kind of know that the rich are, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theory guy. I don't think that Stanley Kubrick faked the moon landing. I don't think the earth is flat or anything like that. I think it's pretty clear that the rich are doing some fucked up shit. Like Bohemian Grove was real. It was caught on tape. Epstein's Island, you know, there's people know that, like, what was that Yale or Harvard rich assholes frat? It's just a rich assholes frat, but they,
oh, skull and crossbones.
Yeah,
bullshit.
And it's just like, yeah. It's like, oh yeah, you lay in a coffin and jerk off while you're talking about your father, and that's your initiation, and then, you know, it's for all these rich people, or fucking David Cameron fucking a pig. Like, this shit really does happen. Seeing it this way and seeing kind of that last scene where the guy's basically saying, like, forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown. And, like, he can't do shit about it. And that is something that is really frustrating in real life today. Because, like, there's just too much power in it for anyone to just look at the stuff that's going on and be like, yeah, sure as fuck, but what can you do? And honestly, it hit really close to home this time.
That reminds me of an earlier scene that I never really could kind of place other than just the general menace of it. But when there's the, you know, the gang of six Yale bros walking down the street, right? And, like, they bump him into the car, and they're like, F this, that, like, all the other F that I'm not going to say.
The droogs that show up.
Yeah.
And, like, is that sort of saying that, like, that's the future of Fidelio? Like, these kids who are, like, on top of the world, nothing can harm them, nothing can stop them, that Cruz is going to be beaten down by them, too?
I like it.
Yeah, look at the news. Like, look how many asshole college guys get away with the fucking date rape shit, right? And, like, it's not... It's commenting on what's happening. You know, it is happening. Yeah, like, I think... And I agree, like, if you... You know, like, I mean, I did spend some time on YouTube once or twice going down the Kubrick conspiracy hole. A lot of it is pretty valid. Like, he did spend a lot of his career sort of trying to just expose, not necessarily conspiracies or stuff, but just the elite. You know what I'm saying? Just, like, people should just not have that much power, and people with that power should not be controlling everybody and all that. And, like, many of his films touch upon that kind of stuff. And it's not always as central to the viewer as he's trying to make it in Eyes Wide Shut, but it's, you know what I'm saying? Like, he really reveals it at the orgy and everything, but it's still, I think, a lot of people misinterpret it or it goes over their head, or they just sort of throw it by the wayside because it's like, oh, look at all the sex, or look at all, you know what I'm saying? There's so much other sensational things happening. Sometimes they might miss the point.
God, this is all making me like this movie more.
Something that I feel ties into him being a doctor as well is the way that he is kind of being led into the simplest, most straightforward, most likely conclusion by, I can't remember the character's name, but Paul.
Oh yeah, it's like Occam's razor.
Well, exactly. That is something you are very much taught in medical school. Look for when you hear hoofprints, think horses, not zebras. I have this pain in my arm. It's a little tingly. I get some spasms in it sometimes. It's most likely that I have some sort of muscle injury or strain. You shouldn't jump to Lou Gehrig's disease over that, you know? And I think the idea that he's kind of been trained to accept the most likely scenario, and he has given it, and I actually genuinely believe Sidney Pollack's character when he says that it was all kind of bullshit. I think that's a reason why he's chosen as doctor. He's like going against his programming, but because everything is just, he's out of his depth. He's so broken and beaten. And again, something I just saw going through it this time with very different eyes.
And I wonder at the end there, like, it probably is the simplest explanation, but also he is so beaten down that, like, at that point you could probably tell him anything, right?
Yeah.
And he would believe it because he's just at the end of his rope.
Yeah.
Yeah, it almost reminded me of sort of like when you deprogram someone from a cult. Like, the brainwashing is
or you're programming
snapped.
Someone as a cult. Like, it's either way, that's, right? Like, it's just it's indoctrinating them into, like...
He's being rewired one way or the other,
yeah.
You know?
Well, yeah. Like, Sidney Pollack has the money. He is the one literally writing the narrative. Like, whatever he says is what Tom Cruise is going to believe. And he knows everything that Tom Cruise has done in this movie, he knows about. Like, he's had a tail on him. He's got little birds everywhere. Like, he's basically Varys, right? Like, he's just, like, everywhere yeah. Tom Cruise goes, he has eyes. And no matter what he tells him in that moment, whether it's the truth or not, that's what Tom Cruise is going to believe. And I think him just saying, it's this, like, it's her, you know, we didn't have her killed. Why would we have her killed? She's a junkie. You said it yourself. Like, it's almost the narrative that Tom Cruise offers to them, right? Like, she's going to have to go to rehab. Oh, perfect. She's going to be our fall guy later if we need one. It's just, yeah. It's, again, the winners write the mm-hmm. history books. The rich write the narrative. Fidelia. Mm-hmm.
As a question, and I guess maybe this is dipping too dangerously close into, like, you know, your headcanon fanfic bullshit. Are we supposed to believe, I guess it's, again, up to what you think and how Tom Cruise perceives it, that she found the mask and put it on the bed, or that, like, you know, they sent some super assassin ninjas to scare him again?
I don't know, but I do want to say that that is the cover photo on Letterboxd for this movie. It's her sleeping next to the mask. And it's like, why is that allowed to
yeah,
be
Jesus.
The photo? Like, that is such a spoiler.
I actually, so this time around, because that always kind of stuck in my craw, but this time around I had a thought about that, and I have nothing to really back this up except for just, I'm just going to say it, like, I think he put it there. I just don't think he remembers putting it there. I think he was in such a state that, like, maybe he wanted to get caught, or it was a fugue kind of thing, but, like, part of me is, like, I think he did that and didn't know he did it because he was trying to face something and, like, wasn't ready yet. Mm. I don't know. I wanted to read something into that and have it not just sit there this time. So I don't know if that interpretation is like...
Yeah, I don't have an answer.
I like that.
I don't know shit, but I think it just, yeah, ties into the fact that it doesn't... Like, he's just so beaten down, and he's reading these conspiracy theories into everything, and yeah, it's probably the most simple answer. It's probably that she just, like, found it, was going to be like, oh, what's this, and then fell asleep. But yeah, you're kind of so with him at that point that you're looking over your shoulder. You can't tell what's real from fantasy.
Tobin, is there anything else about this movie that you want to make sure that we cover that we have not talked about that you're dying to get off your chest?
Only one thing that I remember, there was a lot of criticism of the movie at the time, or not maybe a lot, there was criticism of the time that it clearly is not New York, that it's they've clearly constructed all these, you know, like a block and a half in London Pinewood to make the movie. At the time, just after this movie came out, I moved to New York, and I was like fully on that bandwagon, like, this is not New York. And I think it's actually a real strength of the movie that it's, because it's not New York, this is like this, as we've been saying, this kind of dream alter Stanley Kubrick version of New York. And I think that it actually fits nicely into the texture and atmosphere of the movie, that it's not the New York of real New York, that it's a deliberate kind of stylization of New York. And I think so that was a criticism that I no longer had watching this time.
Some of the that time criticism of this movie, I found a couple of reviews and I was reading through some of them. Man, there were some critics, there was just some real shit takes at the time. Like, some of the people were honestly, like, dinging the movie because Stanley Kubrick can't tell a movie about intimacy. He's too cold and distant and robotic. It's like, yeah, no shit. It was like, was your next article going to be about how Fight Club is, like, grossly hyper-masculine? Like, you fucking idiot. That's the point.
I know, I was going to say, it sounds like he's the perfect person to exactly. explain what a relationship really is to me. Cold, distant, shut off, you know, the separated.
Mike, any other thoughts about Eyes Wide Shut before we maybe play a couple of games and I have a little bit more trivia?
Even though, much like Tobin, like, this is sort of, I won't say this is the my least enjoyable screening or anything like that, but this is just like the one time, like, I just had, I don't know, it was just more difficult for me to watch this time. And I'm not saying that's like a bad thing or anything. I was just like, this movie, I didn't expect it to like re-challenge me in any sort of way. Like, I thought I knew what I was in for, but it just, you know, it's a fucking Kubrick film. So like every time I rewatch one, like, something pops up. I remember last time I saw Clockwork Orange, I went up and watched it at the Draft House with Kyle and Brian, and I mean, I could not stop laughing from beginning to end with the person next to me. Like, it was like, I swear it was a comedy, you know? So, like, every time I watch this, like, I gain something different, and I'll watch it again, and I'll recommend it, and yeah, I'm really psyched that we got to talk about it.
Yeah, me too. I'm glad that you were both here for this. I'm like, I don't think this is necessarily a pivot point in Cruise Club, because I know there's a lot more great movies to come, but I feel like between this and Magnolia next episode, we are at the, like, you know, if this is a mountain, we're at, like, the peak of the mountain, right, in terms of the movies themselves. Like, this is, hoo boy, and not that we're really going to descend rapidly until we get to The Mummy, but, you know, we're reveling in this. Like, this is kind of the Cage Action Week, right? Like, this is the The Rock, Con Air face-off. Like, I can't believe these movies are back-to-back, because, like, what is happening? But also, it feels like that for the whole run. Like, it feels like, how are all these movies... Like, how is Top Gun, like, his fifth movie? Like, what is happening?
Yeah, that was pretty jarring to get used to in the beginning. Was I didn't realize, like, how good it started and maintained and is going to be for the rest of it.
So a few little bits of quick trivia. Cruise and Kidman both signed open-ended contracts to work on this movie. They agreed that no matter how long it took to finish the movie, they would stay on board. And Vincent D'Onofrio, who was in Full Metal Jacket, said apparently he had heard this reported and said as open advice, quote, rent a house or apartment because you're going to be in England for a while. Which, yeah, 400 days is quite a while.
And he was only in half of Full Metal Jacket.
Speaking of how long it took in sort of conflicts, the original part of Victor Ziegler and Marion Nathanson, which was Sidney Pollack and the girl who dies... Oh, huh. Marion is the daughter of the patient. So this is two wildly different things. They're similarly linked together thematically, or reason why this is trivia together, but they're separated from the thing. So the original part, the Sidney Pollack part, was originally going to be Harvey Keitel. He was cast, he shot a bunch. And the Marion part, the daughter of the patient who died, was Jennifer Jason Leigh. And both of them had to back out when they had to do reshoots, like, I guess, presumably months and months or maybe a year later. And like, oh, we're doing other movies now. So they had to recast those. So, you know, we were talking earlier about how Sidney Pollack was recast and, you know, that whole thing at the end. It's so much work there. Like, I can't imagine doing that much work on a movie like this and just being like, oh, like, I didn't expect a year later for you to still be making this. Like, it's not like Marvel now where they, like, they write in reshoots into your contract. Like, you have to come back. Man, wow.
It would be incredible to see that footage these days. You know, that's like the Eric Stoltz Back to the Future footage everyone's trying to get their hands on.
My last little thing is that this movie got no Oscar nominations and only one Golden Globe nomination for Best Original Score, and it did not even win that. So for a movie that we all... you know, admire, even if we don't all love it, it's sort of like a kind of a slap in the face. It was successful at the box office. It cost $65 million to make, and it made $162. So this was, I think, Kubrick's first and only number one opening week box office movie. So this, it was a financial success if it just wasn't necessarily an awards success.
And not uncommon for Kubrick movies to grow in critical esteem after, like, as time goes on, right? Like, I think this movie is a lot more well-regarded today critically than it was certainly when it came out.
It's the kind of movie that definitely ages well over time, right? So
yeah.
I don't know if I'm going to be able to play this game. I don't know if any of us are going to be able to play this game. Imagine for a second that Tom Hanks was cast in the role of Dr. Bill.
Is Rita Wilson?
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, imagine as Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson. What would this look like? Could it work?
No, please, no. I don't think so. I don't know. I don't know. I don't think I want to see
I'm that. Really trying to wrap my brain around this. No, that's it. No, I'm trying so hard, and I don't know.
It's kind of breaking my brain.
I could imagine the Tom Hanks, Rita Wilson, Nora Ephron-directed version of this movie that's like in the Joe versus the Volcano mold of and being allowed to kind of make the movie whatever it's going to be and not sort of stick too close to the thing. And it would be, I think, a much more maybe even-handed look at marriage from two different points of view instead of just solely from this male privilege point of view. And however much it is critiquing it. And I think I would be actually kind of interested in that.
Yeah, it would be much more of a movie about, like, I feel like the domestic couple stuff would be leveled up a little bit and pushed to the forefront, and like, look at these two sexy actors would probably be a little pushed back a little bit. But I think he could do it. He's Tom Hanks. I'm sure he could. You know, should he? Maybe not. Hey, man, I would love to slip into the world where a bunch of celebrity couples Give me Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn. Give me a fucking Ted Danson and Mary Steenburgen. Just give me a world where every celebrity couple has done this movie, and I'm in.
I'd like to see the Nick Offerman,
oh my God,
Megan Mullally version of this
movie. Ooh,
I could see. I would love to see Nick Offerman show up at the orgy.
He would call bullshit on all this so fast.
He would. He goes, "What's with these shenanigans?"
Yeah.
Right now I'm looking. So I'm on slice.ca, so I guess a Canadian website. Here are famous celebrity couples from 1979 to 2019, the last 40 years. I'm going to go through. There's 41 of them. We're not going to do all those. Okay, they're not all actors, because the third one is Prince Charles and Lady Diana. So maybe this won't exactly work. Can we imagine a movie, and this is something that, you know, Chris, you had mentioned earlier, can we imagine this movie with Danny DeVito and Rhea Perlman?
Yes, yes. Give me that movie.
What about Goldie and Kurt Russell?
Yeah, I said that. That'd be a great one, I think.
Yeah, that would be good. I agree, yeah.
Lenny Kravitz and Lisa Bonet?
Holy shit.
Brad Pitt and either Jennifer Aniston or Angelina Jolie, possibly?
Oof.
Although I feel like they did that with her movie By the Sea,
right,
which was not great, and then they got divorced, or not divorced, but they split up like within 6 months, I think so.
Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga.
Oh my God.
How I'm
about
sorry,
Kermit
I hijacked
Piggy.
I've hijacked this so bad and taken it to a very dumb place. I'm sorry.
I like the Kermit. I'd watch that one. Yeah.
What about Jennifer Lopez and Ben Affleck?
Fidelio. Ooh,
oh God.
Okay. What about? I'd rather watch Gardner and Affleck marriage dissolve. Like, there's got to be security camera footage of that somewhere.
I do want to say, I don't know if we've said it on a podcast yet, but Hustlers is pretty great, and Jennifer Lopez is incredible in that. So if you did not see her in Out of Sight, go see Out of Sight. What are you doing? Number one, but also number two. Sort of another incredible performance to put up there on the shelf of Jennifer Lopez, our best living actress, question mark? Not true, but maybe, you know, not wildly incorrect. Other question, other game we're going to play. If you win a walk-on role into this movie, how are you going to Stanley yourself? What is your Stanley cameo, your stameo? Where do you put yourself in this movie? Is it the orgy or is it somewhere else?
Yes, definitely in the orgy. But here's the thing. I would be, and I'm just to be brutally honest, I'm the blindfolded piano player who gets either killed or set back off to Seattle. If I'm being honest, that's who I ended up being in this movie.
I like that.
I was going to be the cab driver that drives him to the place. And just, you know, I've always wondered what happened to him. And I guess he just, you know, they literally were like, "Sir, what are you doing here?" And he was probably like, "Well, I just dropped off this guy. You know, he told me to wait." And they're like, "All right, we'll go get him for you. Just a moment, please." And they probably slipped him like a couple $100 to keep his mouth shut. Just be like, "Just drop this guy back off where you found him. No problem."
Man, I'm trying to think of something, but the masks are so fun. It's like being in the worst Panic at the Disco music video. I think I would, you know, I would want to participate, but I'd certainly want to see some of that horrible shit in real life. So I guess put me in as I don't have much of a face for film anyway. So put me behind a mask.
Put me in, coach. I'm ready to play.
So you're just like one of the corner nodders.
Yeah, definitely someone that's just like yes, okay. This is what I'm doing now. This is
maybe you're one of the CGI figures added.
Oh, yeah.
save American audiences from genitalia.
Yeah,
I heard they were digitally removed for the discs.
Mine looks the one I watched had some real thrusting.
Oh, okay,
like, so, there was nothing blocking them. The one I watched,
they shot it the normal way, and then before he died, Kubrick said, "I know that this is probably going to be like too much for the censors, so like I basically give you permission, or like let's figure out a way to digitally add people." So like, even though that feels like a wild step, like I think he had sort of consented to that, like it's okay to add these in because like I know that this is not necessarily an R-rated movie.
Well, that's what he said. Yeah, I don't know. The version I saw had once again figures standing in, which fine, whatever. But like, it's, Stanley Kubrick's framing is so important, and I just that does bug me that they did.
I got it. I want to be blocking out one of the sex scenes. I want to be a masked guy who is standing there wondering exactly how you 69 when both people are wearing masks.
Oh, yes, I was trying to figure out if those masks were on their faces or not. Like, it feels like there's one that looks like it's like on top of the head, but still, that defeats the whole point of the party. It's a weird thing, man. I don't know where I would be in this movie because I feel like the orgy has been covered in these guesses. I feel like I've done this three or four times, Mike, in the Tom Tom Club. I'm gonna be the guy that you don't necessarily see, but the guy at the newsstand. Like, I just want to be at that newsstand where he buys the paper, where he finds out that Mandy died. Like, there's all these movies, like in The Firm too. I think like there's all these movies where there's just like a newsstand that Cruise visits. Like, just put me there. Why not? You know, that'll give me a use for this journalism degree. Just selling newspapers. the closest thing that I've got to it. So two questions. Does Tom Cruise run in this movie? I think we said no, right?
He walks towards the camera at some point, but I don't think he runs.
Very purposefully. Yeah. Slaps his hands together, but yeah, no running.
You both know, or at least I know Tobin knows because he's been on Cruise Club before. Chris, I don't know if you know, but there's somebody on Twitter, Harperfect or Harperfect, who said that you can replace Tom Cruise's character's name in any movie with the name Lightning McQueen and not a single thing would change. If he was Dr. Lightning McQueen, would it work? I'm going to say he's already so far out of his element that like it's not going to make things worse. I say it works.
No, I hate everything about that. And that's a bad attempt at a meme. I don't like it.
I mean, I'm on board almost every week, so yeah.
So you're the deciding factor. You know, we got Chris saying no. Me and Mike don't really count because we try to say yes every time. It's up to you, Tobin. Yes or no?
No, I'm with Chris on this. I think it's a terrible idea.
All right, the last thing we have to do is nominate this for some awards. We still don't know. Maybe the Fidelios?
Oh.
Ooh, that's good.
Or the Golden Masks. That's what it's got to be.
It's a good one.
The Cruise Club, the Tom Cruise Awards, the best and worst of what his filmography has to offer. Best film, yes, Eyes Wide Shut.
I would argue, yes.
Best director-filmmaker, I will say. This still might go away, but Stanley Kubrick, of course.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do we want to nominate this for best or worst Cruise role?
Well, I don't know that it's I like the performance, but right. I have issues with the role from time to time.
What are the parameters on that? Is that like the plot, like his character, or is it acting?
Well, it's sort of like, you know, like sort of best actor. Like imagine this is the equivalent of best actor, the Oscars, and considering what he's done in other movies and sort of the work that he's put into, does this qualify for one of his best performances?
I think because of those two scenes at the end where he breaks down, and it's so not something you see from him, and it's kind of something that works so well because you're surprised at how well he does it. So, I'd say yeah.
Tobin?
No.
Ooh. Damn. Okay. We'll keep it off. Most badass role, I'm going to say no. Most wasted performance, no. Best fight, he doesn't get into a fight. No. Like they kind of, you know, not literally runs from fights, but he tries to avoid confrontation, like he's able to avoid confrontation. I don't know if he's trying to, but he's able to avoid confrontation.
Yeah, I wouldn't put that in there.
Best theme song / soundtrack / score. I mean, I know it's nominated for Golden Globe, but I feel like
I did a bad thing.
I kind of forgot about that actually. How the song that the piano player plays like diegetically at the orgy becomes the non-diegetic soundtrack throughout the rest of the movie. I thought that was fucking great.
Yeah, in the same way, like when the music starts in the beginning and you're like, oh, this is going to be scored with like classical music, and Tom Cruise just turns it off.
Right. It's in that case, it starts non-diegetic and then you realize it's been diegetic to the scene the whole time. Yeah. And apparently that's music, the music with the ding, ding, is like that wasn't composed for the movie. That's a piece of pre-existing music, which is wild.
And one other thing, apparently, to get her feeling more comfortable, Stanley Kubrick let Nicole Kidman like choose what music to listen to, like when, especially in the nude scenes, because those are apparently very difficult for both of them to shoot. That was just what she used to get into the mood, and he liked it so much that he put it in the movie. So that Chris Isaac was not, I guess, in the script, it was just a Nicole Kidman choice. So, you know, I'm gonna say yes. I think it's an interesting meld of the creepy music and also the diegetic music and all of that. So I'm gonna say yes.
Totally.
Best dance scene. If does Tom Cruise dance?
She
dances.
No. All right. Best Cruise outfit wardrobe.
Ooh, the mask is good. Costume.
Maybe. Yeah.
Best sunglasses, no. Best death, he does not die. Best line or best freak out? Is there something he does either of these things? I think that Nicole Kidman has these in spades. Like the one time, I wrote down one quote from this movie. Those two girls at the party last night, did you, by any chance, happen to fuck them? But she says it with such like so much more space between the words. Like it's just that whole thing is incredible. I don't know if there's anything that Tom Cruise does that is worthy in terms of his career. That is like, does he have any memorable lines in this or any specific? Like, because his freak out is just like exhaustion.
Yeah, it's more of a breakdown. Yeah. I wouldn't call it on the Cage Club Network. I feel like freak out has a much different connotation.
I mean, Cruise has a good number of freak outs. Like he's got a fair number under his belt already. I don't know if this movie necessarily qualifies. Best sex scene for Cruise.
Oof. It is like the point is that it's an extremely unsexy sex scene, so no. It got the point across, but no.
Most athletic feat? I don't think he does anything in this movie that's particularly athletic, unless I'm forgetting something.
No.
Nope.
Best running scene does not run. Best or worst love story? Again, it's about a marriage, but it's not a love story.
I mean, I could certainly see it in there for last. Or for worst, I'm sorry.
All right. So I'll just say Bill. What's her name? Alice?
It is Alice, yes.
Bill and Alice in Eyes Wide Shut. Best ensemble cast? No. And then best non-Cruise actor, male or female, Nicole Kidman, we already have in there. Anybody else in this movie worth nominating in this category?
Not for me.
I don't think so.
I love Sydney Pollack, but, you know, it could have been Harvey Keitel. It wouldn't have changed anything. And Alan Cumming has a great little scene in it, but there's not enough of him. To, and he's so eye-fucking Tom Cruise. It's great. None of them have enough heft, I think, or enough screen time to stand out.
Neither of them are any Jonathan Lipnicki. So, I mean, if you can't compete with the kid from Jerry Maguire, why even bother running? Six nominations. Best film, best filmmaker, best theme song, soundtrack, score, outfit, wardrobe, worst love story, and Nicole Kidman as best non-Cruise actor female, completing her trilogy of Days of Thunder, Far and Away, and Eyes Wide Shut. Well, thank you both for joining us tonight on this supersized episode of Cruise Club. One of you, I will not say who, will be back in 2 weeks for Magnolia. Chris, if you have an elevator pitch, what's your 30-second spiel on what Now and Again, your podcast comes out twice a month with Nico. What is your pitch? What is Now and Again?
It's basically the orgy scene in a podcast form. So
cool.
So come in. We won't make you take your mask off. It's about pop music. We're going through the Now That's What I Call Musics chronologically, but that's miserable a lot of the time. So we take a lot of fun detours through weird and nostalgic and even some modern pop music. So if you're into that, come on over. It's fun.
Awesome. And actually, this might be your series wrap on Tom Tom Club, unless you add to a movie later. I think this might be the last that you chose. So this might be could this be the farewell? I guess that's also a spoiler for who's coming back for Magnolia. But I think, I don't know if you're coming back, but Chris, thank you for joining us on both Mazes and Monsters in this episode. You've been a delight.
You're very welcome. Before I go forever, there's one very important thing we need to do though.
What's that?
Fuck.
That means to be the end of the episode, but can't be the end of the episode. But Tobin, what about you? If you have to explain your elevator pitch of what The Contenders is, the podcast you do with your sister Islin, who's been on these podcasts before, who was on our ragtag bunch of misfits, The Outsiders at least, what is The Contenders?
The Contenders is a podcast about movies directed by and or starring fearless women. So that's it. Come check it out.
So this episode comes out next Friday, the 27th, which means that you just put out an episode of The Contenders, your first after a little hiatus. What movie, you announced it forever ago, but what movie is it that you're doing? Pitch Perfect 2, is that right?
Pitch Perfect 2, baby, yeah.
Wonderful. So go check out The Contenders for our Pitch Perfect 2, where Tobin and Island return to form after a nice little summer vacation.
That's right.
I hope you return to form. I hope it's not like we're not overselling an episode that may or not be recorded yet, but...
It has been recorded, and I have to say it is excellent, if I do say so.
Wonderful.
Myself. Mostly because of Islin.
Of course. I mean, Islin's the best. And then, Mike, you have Third Time's a Charm. A new episode comes out. You got a double dip in October for your Halloween horror spooky month. And then we've got Too Fast, Too Forever and Boyfriend Material. Go check those out on a weekly basis too. But for all things Cruise Club and Hanks for the Memories and Tom Tom Club, you can go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, or at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email us, run@cageclub.me. Come back next week on the Hanks for the Memories feed for Radio Flyer, and come back in 2 weeks for Magnolia, plus the Amy Mann music video, Save Me, which is the real... We know that. That's why you want to come back for that one sweet Amy Mann video. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Chris Mattiello of Now and Again and Tobin Addington of The Contenders, and we'll see you next time for Magnolia right here on Cruise Club. Oh, that's easy.